This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this third Monday in December, a special conversation with a journalist who's had an amazing year. He's been partly responsible for transforming our understanding of how the United States conducts intelligence since the September 11th attacks. Glenn Greenwald received the leaked documents from former security official Edward Snowden, who used his top security clearance with a government contractor to uncover a vast set of programs where the National Security Agency was watching American citizens. The U.S. government had quietly and completely changed its way of doing things, using advanced technology and a sense of righteousness in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Here's then Vice President Dick Cheney speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on September 16th, 2001, with late Tim Russert. America was going to change, he said then.
A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
There have been restrictions placed on the United States intelligence gathering, reluctance to use unsavory characters, those who violated human rights, to assist in intelligence gathering. Will we lift some of those restrictions?
Well, I think so. I think one of the byproducts, if you will, of this tragic set of circumstances is that we'll see a very thorough sort of reassessment of how we operate and the kinds of people we deal with. If you're going to deal only with officially approved, certified good guys, you're not going to find out what the bad guys are doing.
How much America changed became clear with the Snowden leaks this year, a vast archive of secrets we have barely begun to understand. Reporter, writer, commentator, civil libertarian Glenn Greenwald, who spoke with us last week from Brazil, says that the Snowden revelations show that in the years since 9/11, in conducting intelligence, not only has the United States become more like Dick Cheney's bad guys, we are less safe than if, in his view, we had done nothing in response to the attacks.
I absolutely think that doing nothing would have been better than what we did, because what we did ended up creating so much more problems in terms of a terrorist threat than ever existed prior to 9/11. I mean, if you go around the world and spend a decade beating your chest and declaring yourself a nation at war, dropping bombs in multiple countries on the planet, killing all sorts of innocent men, women, and children, putting people in cages without trial, creating a worldwide torture regime, popping up dictators, what you're essentially telling the world is you ought to hate us and you ought to be filled with rage and want to bring the kinds of violence to our country that we saw on 9/11. There were all sorts of things that could have been done that were reasonable security measures in terms of tightening up the borders, focusing more on the people who we had reason to believe were genuinely the kind of threat that we were worried about. We could have provided better aid to the countries that were combating extremism, helped, instead of building huge surveillance systems, alleviated a lot of the poverty and misery and primitive conditions in countries that fuel terrorism. There are all kinds of things that we could have done to reduce that threat further. But I think what we did made the threat much, much worse, and at the same time destroyed many of the freedoms that we've all been taught define what the United States is about.
All right. In terms of whether the government is permitted to carry out surveillance against American citizens, or whether there is a value to the data that a company like Google or Apple or AT&T might have about American citizens, the Constitution has a lot to say about what the government can do with that data. It has almost nothing to say about what corporations can do with that data. In the commercial world, is the era of privacy and constitutional government really over? And it's sort of immaterial whether the government is watching you or Google is watching you at this stage in 2013?
I'd say two things about that. Number one is that there's a reason why the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, restricts what states can do to you, but not corporations or private actors. And that is because the government has a whole set of very extreme powers that make it a different and more threatening kind of actor. It can put you into prison. It can actually take your life. It can take your property. It can tax you. It can monitor you for all sorts of purposes. And so I think it's always been understood that having a government do something like gather ubiquitous information about what citizens are doing poses a greater threat than corporations doing it, because even though it is a threat when corporations do it, they tend to do it for profit motive rather than to, say, weed out political dissidents or blackmail Martin Luther King as J. Edgar Hoover did and the like. So I think there is a significant difference. But even on the corporate level, I think one of the things that you're seeing in terms of the last 6 months of the reporting we've done is a lot of different kinds of pressure being put on private corporations like Google and Facebook to start taking the privacy of their customers a lot more seriously. And you've seen people like Mark Zuckerberg express very serious worries that the U.S. government, through the message it's sending to the world, is jeopardizing the ability of the U.S. tech industry to compete internationally. You see in multiple other countries different kinds of social network and email providers advertising the fact that, unlike Facebook and Google, they don't go through the U.S. infrastructure, and therefore they can guarantee you privacy in a way that U.S. firms can't. And that competition is working, and there's encryption tools that are being developed to prevent even Google and Facebook from reading your emails or collecting your online activity. So I think there's a lot of responses, not just to government spying, but to corporate spying as well, that's going to make it a lot harder for these companies to continue doing what they've been doing.
Is there a difference, though, between a sense of, you know, reverence for the Constitution and, you know, the government staying out of your business, and maybe being more concerned about your brand? I'm wondering if Facebook really cares about the Constitution, or just cares about not having Eric Holder being on its front page.
Right. I think the thing that Facebook cares about most is the recognition that in order to continue to grow as a company, it needs to have the trust of hundreds of millions of people around the world who they want to use their service. And if the message continues to be communicated to the rest of the world by the U.S. government, which is, we do protect the privacy of Americans, but we don't actually protect the privacy of non-Americans. All these programs that are being revealed, these are only aimed at foreign nationals, which isn't really true, but it's what the government's saying. I think that's the kind of thing that really is jeopardizing the ability of U.S. tech firms to compete. And ultimately, corporations are going to be guided by their own self-interest. You can't expect them to act morally. And so if you're somebody who wants to defend privacy and to reinstitutionalize the idea that you can do things on the internet without people being monitored, I think the important thing is to raise the cost to companies like Facebook and Google from participating in this kind of privacy assault. And I do think that's what's happening.
Over the last year, have you noticed that there's kind of this subgenre of media, of journalism, of broadcast journalism, you know, kind of like match wits with Glenn Greenwald, debates of you going viral all over the place, you versus Andrew Sullivan, you versus Dina Temple Raston. I mean, I can find all kinds of little boxing matches with you and either other journalists or pundits. What do you think of all that?
I mean, in general, I think that adversarial journalism and a clash of ideas can be a really constructive way to test people's views and to find truth. I think the problem comes when that kind of aggression and that kind of adversarial posture is directed at people who don't wield a lot of power in official Washington, who tend to be outsiders. And then suddenly when those very same people who get very aggressive when dealing with people like that are before generals with lots of medals on their chest or big established journalists who are revered in Washington, the tone changes completely and it becomes one of great deference and an aversion to confrontation. And I think that's when things get quite telling. But in general, you know, I think if you're out there and you're having an impact on the public discourse and you're making claims that people ought to listen to what you have to say, as I do, then you're absolutely fair game to have your viewpoints challenged aggressively. You just need to be prepared to have your own views challenged aggressively back.
Getting back to the Snowden leaks, and it's really a story of technology and journalism and the Constitution. And this is really an old story. Let's take the nuclear example. Some scientists go to the government and say, hey, you know, we can do this with these atoms and we should develop this to stop Hitler. And the government says, great, let's get started on that. We'll definitely do that. Oh, you know what? We're not going to bother with Hitler, but we are going to kill 100,000 civilians in Japan. It's an old story. Technology becomes available. Government uses it for what it wants. And people who stand around going, oh, gosh, they lied to us. It's kind of an old story. It's kind of naive. What would you expect they would do with this technology?
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you say, except that I would say the following. You know, I've been doing a lot of reporting on from NSA documents in lots of different countries, and so we'll report on mass NSA spying in Norway or in Brazil. And I always get asked by the journalists in those countries, "Well, we're just Norway. Why is the NSA spying on us? Why are they interested in us?" Or same question in Brazil. And the answer is that the United States doesn't actually need, or the NSA doesn't need, a specific reason in order to spy and on people and collect their communications. They do it because they've developed this technology that lets them do it, and their institutional mandate is just to constantly seek out more and more. They don't need a reason. Their only reason for existing is, we've developed this technology originally to target people in Iraq in a war zone, but now that we have it, we're going to use it across the board. And you're right, that is a common dynamic, that technology gets out of control. But that's the reason why there needs to be transparency, so people know what's being done, why there needs to be accountability, so there are limits on it.
But you can't develop, you know, a nuclear bomb with transparency and telling everybody what you're doing. I mean, there are technological developments that happen in secret, and that's the way things are done. And when the Constitution gets involved later on, that's something else. But I guess I don't quite see how we're going to avoid this kind of thing by simply arguing that people be constrained. They're definitely not. They don't do it this way.
Well, take your nuclear example, which is a really good one. Countries began developing nuclear weapons in total secrecy. There was no framework for them. There were no limitations on any kind about how they could be used or stored. And the world realized that that was a really bad and dangerous thing to do, to let nuclear development take place outside of a framework of international accountability. And so countries got together and they created treaties and conventions and a nuclear regulatory framework to ensure that there are inspections and that there are rules that countries agree to and abide by for how to safely manage this technology that could have spun out of control if it didn't have that kind of framework. And that's how I see surveillance technology. You're right. Human beings are always going to try and develop more technologies to give themselves greater power. And the challenge is for then is for other human beings to organize on their own to come up with ways to control and limit that technology so it doesn't do massive amounts of harm. And this kind of tension is critical.
All right. So have you thought about what the equivalent of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in terms of surveillance using technological tools?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. Number one is, I think you are now seeing countries around the world banding together to start to figure out ways to reconstruct the internet so that it doesn't all go through essentially one country, the United States, and subject the physical infrastructure of the internet to international oversight instead of just control by the U.S. government, so that one government can't invade the communications of everybody else. And then I also think that there are individual solutions being developed, such as technological innovations in cryptography and encryption, in creation of all kinds of independent networks that'll make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the U.S. government and other governments around the world to invade those networks. So I think technology will provide an answer, as well as it so often does, to the problems that it's created.
Glenn Greenwald is the journalist who worked with the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden to publish and report on classified NSA programs. You can find a full transcript of our interview with Greenwald by visiting our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.